when I made up the outline for this session, when I was at home in Port Angeles, I was going to open this session by telling you, giving you several examples of what I understand about by the phrase gift exchange. And one of those examples is the first salmon ceremony that is used by a number of Northwest Native American tribes. So I got to Holden Village, and Mark Kremen was here, and I said, you know, have you heard of this? Have you ever done this? Of course, he's been to a number of them. And I was pretty excited and was hoping that he would actually be able to be here to have, so that I could have him tell you what the first salmon ceremony is like. But he went out today. However, due to the wonders of technology, I got him yesterday to tape 3 or 4 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes of explaining what the first salmon ceremony is about. And to me, it makes more sense to hear it from somebody that's been there rather than from me, who has only read about it in books. So.
Yeah, hello. My name is Mark Kremen Teal. I'm from the Skokomish tribe from Washington State. It's on the lower part of Puget Sound in Hood Canal. We are a recognized tribe that is about 800 members and a size of about 600 acres. We in the Pacific Northwest have a very strong tradition. We are part of the Salmon people and the Cedar people. The Salmon people, which my background is from, is a tradition that we use a ceremony for the first salmon coming up river, that we, in our tradition, we capture the first salmon coming up our river. And it's a very ritualistic ceremony for us as the salmon people, to honor the salmon, because the salmon are one of our brothers. And it ends up, we reverend the salmon because it's our part of our sustenance for life, and it helps us continue on living. Just as in the Christian community, when they give thanks at a table, it ends up, we, in our Indian tradition, we give thanks to the fish that have come up river. The ceremony that is done is a ceremony that is done with everybody in the tribe, and any neighboring tribal peoples come up to whichever reservation that has caught the first salmon coming up the river. When the salmon is caught, it is first blessed when it's caught on the boat. And when the boat has killed the salmon, it ends up, the salmon is quickly taken from the boat directly to a fire pit for cleaning. And then when the cleaning is done and the cooking is done, everybody in the village is offered a piece of the first salmon that had come up the river. It ends up, it's a way of each and everybody in the tribe and neighboring tribes that whomever has eaten the salmon is reverence to that salmon. When the salmon has been cooked and eaten, the bones and the head of the fish and the insides of the fish are taken back down directly after the eating of the meal and given right to the same area of the river or the place that it has been caught, because it ends up, that is where its ending point of his life or her life was. So it ends up, we give it back to the river in reverence, and the parts of the fish that is given back to the water where it had come from. We ask that the other coming fish, salmon, that are coming up river, know that we ate it in reverence, and we, in our tradition, we feel the bones and the head and the insides of the fish are still parts of the soul of the salmon, which helps go back to the other salmon coming up river And what we do, we have a couple of salmon songs. We have salmon prayers before the meal, and a prayer not only after catching the salmon, but also a prayer song when we're giving parts of the fish back to the river, so that the when the parts of the salmon that goes back into the river, in our tradition, we feel that understands our language, and what we want the bones to do is talk to the other salmon coming up to the river, that we come in peace to our salmon people, our salmon brothers, because the Insa, we feel the salmon brothers are the ones that are helping us continue to live. And we want the continuing salmon coming up the river be able to know that we come in peace and in harmony, that we hope that they will know that we're wanting them to know that we only take the food that we need and no more.
Were you able to understand?
Yeah.
What the salmon comes up, they eat the salmon, everybody shares it, then they take the head and the bones, take it back down to the river, and it goes out and lets the salmon that are coming in know that it's being done in reverence. I'd like to put alongside of it another story. When Elizabeth and I got married in 1981, we got wedding presents. Among those wedding presents was a green glass bowl, which was not particularly attractive. What do you do with it? Well, we put it in the closet and didn't think about it. The next year, we got married in November. A year later, as we were getting ready for Christmas, we got out our Christmas ornaments and ran into the green glass bowl again. And we brought it out and thought, well, what should we do with it? And it's a little bit hard to just throw away something that you've gotten as a present, even if it's ugly. That Christmas, my brother-in-law got a mysterious present under the Christmas tree. He got a green glass bowl. The next year, somebody else in the family got the green glass bowl. The next year, somebody else in the family got a green glass bowl. At some point, one of my sisters made a nice cloth bag that the bowl resides in now between Christmases. And one of my other sisters started a little booklet documenting the course of, the different travels of this bowl from one person to another. And it continues up to the present time. I'm not sure who has it right now, because we don't all have Christmas together, and you never know when it's going to come back to your particular household, but it kind of makes the rounds. Are there any similarities that strike you between the two stories it's not real obvious, so I connections, yeah.
Well, in each case, everyone gets to share.
Okay.
And no one gets to no one really gets to cling to the thing. It's not like something you can hoard and keep to yourself forever. Even when you have it, it's only yours to kind of pass on to someone else.
Okay. I think that's the key idea, and that's one of the key elements in what I understand and what I mean by gift exchange. That when you get a gift, that it's not something that sits with you, but that you somehow are encouraged or motivated to move it along or to move something else along. What does any of this have to do with art? Good question. Lewis Hyde has written a book called The Gift, Imagination and the Erotic Life of Property. I'll get into the title of it a little bit later. But this has been a particularly useful book for me over the years in understanding both the creative process and the way that works of art move or travel or change hands after they are completed. And that's essentially what I would like to share with you tonight, is just some of my ideas and some of Hyde's ideas. Before I get back to the art business, I have to get away from it again, and I would like to just go a little bit more into this notion of gift exchange, especially as Hyde understands it. Hyde talks about two ways that goods move between people or parties, individuals, whatever. It's a simplistic division, but he says that things move in one of two ways, one of them being through what he calls a gift economy, the other is through a market economy. In a gift economy, in a gift exchange, we have, just as in the case of these two stories we talked about, the encouragement to keep things in motion. If I gave one of you $5, a $5 bill on Saturday just before I got on the bus and I went down lake and you never saw me again, what would you do with that $5? Odds are that you would treat that $5 a little differently than the $5 that you earned at your job last week. I'm guessing you might be inclined to treat people at the snack bar. Gift exchange also has a way of affirming relationships. It builds up relationships whenever something is given from one person or one party to another. If I gave you $5 and I stayed in the village, every time we passed on the street, our relationship, you would say hi to me probably in a little different light than if I hadn't given you the $5. Hyde suggests that within this gift economy that there are three obligations. The obligation to give. Everybody that's involved has to give something. The obligation to receive. When something comes to you, you have to accept it. And thirdly, the obligation to keep things in motion. That when you receive, you don't just stop there. You give it on or you give something else on. Good example, I was trying out some of these ideas with my wife back in Port Angeles, and she had just read a little bit in The Other Side magazine and opened this little bit to me. I'll read the story of Tilly, just a couple paragraphs about Tilly Black Bear, a Native American woman. To me, a traditional woman is someone who believes in the basic principles of life, such as the concept of generosity, giving away, the lack of attachment to material things. In non-Indian societies, things are kept and handed down from one generation to another. In Lakota society, when a person dies, you share their things with people you know. Last April, I didn't have any money on me, but I had a white shawl with a big eagle on the back that had been given to me as a gift from Martin Brokenleg when he got his doctorate. I'd had it for 5 or 6 years, and I really cherished that shawl. But that was the only thing I had of value on me, so I gave it to someone I appreciated. In the traditions of my people, a gift is not a gift until you give it away. There's a marvelous story in this book. Incidentally, this book is in the bookstore, and it's interesting. It is listed as literary criticism and sociology. It could just as well be fairy tales, theology, art, literature. It's hard to categorize. It throws all of this together with the idea of gift exchange. And if you get in there sometime, I'd suggest you page through it, and I'm sure you'd find it intriguing. But one of the stories that he talks about in here is the work of an anthropologist, Marcel Mauss, who... M-A-U-S-S, Moss, Mouse, who went down to the Trobriand Islands down in the area of Papua New Guinea, down in that area. And the people that live on these islands have taken this whole notion of gift exchange to very elaborate and involved extremes, that they have a series of circles around the islands, some going clockwise, some going counterclockwise, and they have ritualistic objects, in some cases some shell necklaces, in some cases some armbands. The armbands all go clockwise and the shell necklaces go counterclockwise. And they, in some cases, travel literally hundreds of miles across the seas in small boats to give these gifts. And the same gifts go round and round. It may take from 2 to 10 years for a single gift to make the round of the islands, while others are going in the other direction. Why do people bother with that sort of thing? Well, it's because of that relationship building function that gift giving has. The people on the Trobriand Islands understand that this gift giving is something that holds them together in community. Among Northwest Coast Native Americans, there are some marvelous names that individuals carry that also show this sense of gift exchange. Examples include, this is a translation of someone's name, always giving black blankets while walking, the dance of throwing away property, whose property is eaten in feasts. These people live with a different sense of giving than what we are often used to. In contrast to the gift economy is, of course, the market economy. And there's not a whole lot to be said about that, just a few things to help define the market economy. Whereas in a gift economy, gift exchange, the idea is to keep things moving. In a market economy, there tends to be the impetus to have things come to rest, often with yourself. You want to accumulate things. Yes, you may be involved in selling things, but that's to get more money coming to yourself that it sits. What does that do? Well, there's no community building function involved in that sort of thing. In fact, quite the opposite. It's often necessary that you have a certain distance from the people that you are involved in market exchange with. If you go to the hardware store to buy a hammer, you just go there because you want the hammer. You're not particularly interested in finding out about the health of the kids of the guy that's selling you the hammer. And a market economy is necessary. I don't want to sound like I'm automatically judging one is better and the other is worse. They both have their functions. An example might be counselors, psychiatrists, that sort of thing. There are things that when you pay somebody and you expect a service in return, you want the distance of that relationship. You don't want a cozy buddy-buddy relationship. That's why you go to a counselor for certain things and not always to friends. So there are positive reasons to engage in market economy. I want to make it clear that I'm not trying to divide the world into good and bad that way. It is particularly interesting to note places where those two economies come into conflict or where they intersect. An example that I believe was in here was of a Native American man in one of the Dakotas who won a lottery, won a fair chunk of money. And what did he do with the money? He took it to the reservation and threw a big party. Treated all his friends, all the people on the reservation, and they had a great old time. So he used something that was given to him as a way to enhance relationships with those people that were important to him. How was that looked on by the white folks observing from afar? Well, that just goes to show that you can't trust Indians, that they don't know how to handle money correctly. People coming from the point of view of a market economy see what happens there in a completely different light. Go back to that question, what does any of this have to do with art? Hyde suggests that the values of gift exchange are a necessary part of the creative process. He suggests numerous instances where artists look at the inspiration stage of the creative process as a gift. Certainly in centuries gone by, we know that that various artistic endeavors have been attributed to the muses, to these voices that would whisper in the ears of artists or poets or playwrights, whatever. There was that sense of the inspiration coming as a gift, not as something that you could make happen at a certain particular time. You could set the ground, you could prepare yourself, but that when the inspiration came, it was in and of itself a gift. There's a marvelous account in this book by Theodore Rothke, or Rethke, a poet, who writes, "I was in that particular hell of the poet, a longish dry period. It was 1952, I was 44, and I thought I was done. I was living alone in a biggish house in Edmonds, Washington. I had been rereading and rereading, not Yeats, but Raleigh and Sir John Davies. I had been teaching the five-beat line for weeks. I knew quite a bit about it, but write it myself, no. So I suddenly felt a fraud. You can't make the gift come. The gift has to come of its own. Suddenly, in the early evening, the poem, The Dance, started and finished itself in a very short time, say 30 minutes, maybe in the greater part of an hour. It was all done. I felt, I knew it, I had hit it. I walked around and I wept, and I knelt down. I always do that after I've written what I know is a good piece. But at the same time, I had, as God is my witness, the actual sense of a presence, as if Yeats himself were in that room. The experience was in a way terrifying, for it lasted at least half an hour. That house, I repeat, was charged with a psychic presence. The very walls seemed to shimmer. I wept for joy. He, they, the poets dead, were with me." He certainly had the sense of a gift having been received. It's interesting to note, though, that in that account, he talked about having been teaching, was it the five-beat line for a number of weeks? So there is also some preparation and there is some work involved. That also is part of the creative process. We can't negate that. It's not that artists just sit around all day and wait for inspiration to come. There is, what was it, Einstein said, creativity is 2% inspiration, 98% perspiration. There is that work that is involved in the whole thing. But that sense of inspiration as gift, Hyde suggests, is integral. I mentioned one of the ways that you can think about or categorize this book also is dealing with fairy tales. He looks at the gift exchange involved in a number of fairy tales, and one in particularly has been a particularly helpful metaphor for me for thinking about the creative process. You probably are familiar with the story of the shoemaker and the elves. We don't know why, but the shoemaker and his wife have come on hard times. The shoemaker has just enough leather to cut out one last pair of shoes. He does that one night and goes to sleep and intends to finish the shoes in the morning. During the night, two little naked elves come and they sew together the shoes. The shoemaker wakes up in the morning, the shoes are made, they're wonderfully made. He takes them and sells them. The craftsmanship is so good that he sells them, gets enough money to buy leather, to make the leather for two pair of shoes. He cuts that out, and that process continues for several nights. Until finally, he and his wife decide to stay up one night and see who is making these shoes. They note that the elves are working naked, so out of gratitude, the cobbler makes a pair of shoes for the elves, and his wife makes some clothes for the elves. The next night, they stay up to watch the two elves come in. They see the clothes, and they say, "We're sleek, we're fine, we're out the door, we shan't be cobblers anymore." Where's the gift in that? How does it move? What does it do? you have the sense that the cobbler's worth or talent comes in the night. There's an element of mystery, an element of gift in it. The elves come and give him the solution to that problem. But then the cobbler receives something from the muse, receives something from the tradition, but then he gives something back. It's interesting that the tradition, the elves, have need of the cobbler as well. They're naked. There is this sense in working within an artistic tradition that you take things from those that have gone on before, whether it's pottery, painting, or whatever, and that you give something back to the tradition as well. The question arises then that if there is an element of gift in the creation of a work of art, does that imply anything as far as what happens to the art after it's completed? For starters, I think it suggests that the whole business of marketing a piece is something that need not and should not be brought into the creative process. I think we're all familiar with, maybe haven't read, but we at least know what Harlequin romances are. That sort of, you know, that those things are written by formula. There's a certain number of pages, or, you know, kind of a range of pages to make these successful in the market. You know, the heroine must be recently divorced, but still chaste, and you know there's a certain characteristics for the heroine, certain characteristics for the hero, certain way to have this come to a conclusion at the end. It's market research has said that this will make a successful book. The question arises: is that going to be an enduring piece of art? When that market sense gets into the creative process, all indications are it may sell, but it's not going to be an enduring piece of art. Another problem that sometimes arises is that the issues, the sorts of ideas that art addresses, are the sorts of ideas and values that are not very easy to commodify. Something that has emotional or historical value to us is something that it's hard to make the leap and put some worth onto it. It's like a family heirloom. You know, you can take your great-grandmother's diamond ring to a jeweler and get an appraisal on it, the value of the diamond, but the connections that exist, the emotional connections, make it hard to really put a value on it. I think that's true also with art, that the sorts of connections that are involved in the subject matter of art make it hard to make that next step into the market economy. However, because artists need to keep body and soul together, it's necessary for them to have income. That presents an awkward situation. You know, we have the options that have second jobs. An artist that may work as a waiter or waitress. That's one way to keep the two economies separate. We have the case of artists that may have patrons. Patrons don't exist as often in the current situation is what we think of back in the Renaissance, although now we have all these grants, NEA and otherwise, that sort of serves as modern patronage. The third option is that you end up with artists that sell their work, and that becomes their source of income. And that is often problematic. There's a rather pathetic example of Salvador Dali. I'm sure you're at least familiar with. He has this big mustache and did the paintings with the drippy clocks. The name of the painting was The Persistence of Time. I think that's one of his best-known ones. Did lots of surrealist work. a lot of the work was as much about him as a persona as what the actual content of the work was. As he got farther and farther on in his career, he did a lot of printmaking. He began signing blank sheets of paper. And using assistance, he was able to sign up to 1,800 sheets per hour, and he bragged about what profitable work it was. These blank sheets of paper then were taken, and some sort of quick print was put on it and some glitter to make it seem surrealistic, and it was sold as original Salvador Dali's. It had his signature on it. Well, of course, at a certain point, this all came kind of crashing in on him, and in the later years of his life, his financial empire was just in shambles. And you have this kind of pathetic example of someone who, I think we can look at it, did not take seriously the nature of art as a gift. He saw it purely in the light of market exchange, and the quality of his work and the quality of his life suffered significantly because of that. The relationship between the artist and the market is always going to be a particularly difficult one. It's awkward at best. But there are from time to time examples of individuals who I think do a good job of incorporating the ideas and value of gift exchange into not only the way they work, but the way they have their artwork with the communities around them. I'd like to show just a few slides, tell you a little bit about two of these artists, and show a few slides of their work. I'll mention first, the first one is Robert Davidson, who is, should be no surprise, given some of the examples that I've used, a Northwest Coast Native American artist. He was Haida. He was born in the Queen Charlotte Islands in 1946. As a boy, he grew up whittling simple toys from beechwood. And while at high school in Vancouver, he was exposed to the rich tradition of his people. At age 19, he met Bill Reed, a famous artist, carver, and jeweler. He wanted to go to school at Reed's school, but there were no openings. But Reed saw some spark in him and said, "I will take you on as my apprentice." And this time of working with Bill Reed gave him just a rich education in the tradition of his people. He went back at a certain point to his home on the Queen Charlotte Islands and was quite saddened by the loss of quality art in his village. He was saddened by the lack of stories that were being told about the old values, about the old ways, and he decided to do something about it. And his response was to carve the first significant totem pole that was erected in the Queen Charlotte Islands for many, many years. It was a 4 foot wide, 48 foot long totem pole that his grandfather had some role in picking out the tree that was used for the totem pole. He did all the work on it himself. His grandfather was actually able to attend the raising of the pole and died 3 weeks later, which is just kind of a wonderful little anecdotal addition to that story. But this pole ended up giving back to the tradition at the same time because it rekindled an interest among the other villagers, among other artists within the Queen Charlotte Islands. And all kinds of ceremonial regalia was needed for the pole-raising ceremony, and it was this great upwelling of talent and creative endeavor when this pole was erected. Unfortunately, I was not able to come up with a photo of the pole, but I do have some photos of. He's primarily known now for printmaking, and that's largely what I have. Do you want to? I'll just say a few words about some of these, more descriptive than anything else. This was an eagle. When I was talking about gift exchange, I of course could have mentioned the whole potlatch tradition that is so strong among Northwest Coast Native tribes, that, and the whole gift-giving thing is very strong in that as well. This particular eagle was the invitation for Oliver Adams' potlatch. When the previous chief had died, Oliver Adams was to become the next chief. And when you do, when you give a potlatch, you accumulate gifts that you're going to be able to give away. That's the thing about a gift economy, is the only reason to ever accumulate, to kind of hoard things, is if you're doing that in order to later give them away. This was the invitation to that potlatch. There's kind of an interesting little sidelight. Davidson wanted to do to design this invitation and not charge anything, but he found out that the tribal tradition was that if you hire somebody for a particular person, you must pay them. So he accepted payment for doing this, but then, if you would go to the next slide, he did another version of it in two colors that then became his gift. So that was an interesting kind of juxtaposition of both of the economies working, understanding and making use of the relationship building function of the gifts, while not going counter to another tradition in the village.
How was this painted?
How was this painted? These are prints, so they're like woodblock prints that multiple copies could be made. Mm-hmm. So that many copies of this were made and given as gifts to the different people that came to the potluck.
But to get two colors with a woodblock?
Two different blocks.
Oh, okay. I'm not an artist.
Yeah.
So need
you do one and then do the other one on top of it. So you have to get them to line up properly and so forth. Run them through the press that way. But okay, next one. This was an this kind of interesting. This was an ordination invitation. A nephew in his village was ordained a deacon in the Church of St. John the Evangelist, and he designed this for that. The next one, please. This was Robert Davidson's marriage announcement. It's kind of interesting that he is an eagle representing the clan that he is from, but his wife is non-native, and you don't put a non-native into a clan. So she is portrayed, that's the way a human would be portrayed in the Northwest Coast. So you have an eagle embracing a human, it becomes their wedding invitation. Next one, please. And this I find just fascinating. This is the birth announcement of his first daughter. These lungs are emphasized there. He was present at the birth of his daughter, and it was a pretty profound experience for him. And he remembers his wife's very regular breathing, and he chose to portray that through those emphasized lungs. The eyes are partially closed, which was his way of portraying his wife's kind of bearing down and the hard work that's involved in giving birth. And the infant is, interestingly, actually helping kind of climb out.
Yeah.
And what that does is lines up with some of the native mythical beginnings as people that emerged from clamshells. That's the way some of the native understand their creation as a species is emerging, climbing out of clamshells. So he saw the birth of his daughter as sort of a recapitulation of that idea. Next one, please. He continues to work some in three dimensions. I just put a couple in here. This is a silver bracelet
that he did, and this next one is a mask. Okay, the next artist that I would like to just introduce to you as another, I think, creative example of one who understood something of gift exchange and gift economy is a Norwegian artist, Gustav Vigeland. If you've been to Oslo, you have probably seen some of his work. In 1899, Vigeland made a proposal to the city of Oslo that he would create a fountain for the city. The idea evolved as the city council debated whether or not to accept his offer. And he actually worked for 10 years on bronze figures that would be used around this fountain. There was a central group of giants supporting a bowl, and there were surrounding figures and trees. In 1921, he came back to the city and suggested that the city might build him a larger studio. He, in turn, for the rest of his life, would turn over all of his work to the city. So it became a reciprocal arrangement between him and the city. They gave him a place to work. He'd give the city all of his art. He did have some cash income from bust commissions and woodcuts that gave him money to buy groceries and so forth, but the main part of his work was done as this sort of gift exchange. The original fountain became the nucleus for what ended up being just a very large sculpture park, a granite groups of figures that depict various stages of life. Let's go to the next slide.
If I can get the a little darker.
These are some of the bronze figures that are part of the original fountain arrangement. Next slide, please. And that is a huge 50-foot tall granite monolith, which is the central focal point of this park. There's 121 different figures on that huge monolith going up. And then all these granite figures around the outside depict various stages of human life.
Is that a fountain?
And there's...
No.
No, that isn't a fountain right there, no.
And every emotion, too.
Every emotion, absolutely.
Including the two-year-old with the temper tantrum.
Right. Mm-hmm. I have several of them in here. Let's go to the next one. This is a couple from the group that he entitled Encounter. He has a number of sculptures, not individually titled, but they're simply in the group called Encounter. This is one. Let's go to the next one. This is also Encounter. He explored all stages of life, and some of the work was somewhat controversial. It was somewhat explicit. One of the groups was called the Anger of Sex, and this is a group of a pair of figures from that particular group. This is from the group of Mother and Child, Father and Child. Father and Child again. Youth and Old Age. And the last one that I have is simply Old Age. It's not always an optimistic, upbeat view of the human condition. It's very frank and honest. But in part, he had the freedom to do that because of this relationship with the city. He could do things the way with to be consistent with his own vision, because he, at that point, didn't have to think about the market, didn't have to think about selling things. But he had been given a great trust by the city, and the city, I think, received a great gift back in return. And that's pretty much what I have. turn lights on and invite any questions or comments.
What would you say if we said your mother and I gave you that green bowl?
I know that's not true. I know that's not true.
David, what city was this sculpture in?
It's in Oslo.
Wow.
It's called, the name of the park begins with an F. I can't.
I thought it was Zeeland Park.
That's Zeeland Park.
Frogner Park, F-R-O-G-N-E-R.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. One of my very favorite statues there is a very old couple, and they're old because he has this beautiful muscle structure out, but it's this flabby, and there's this gentleness between the two, and to me I always thought of that of the gift of friendship through many years. Mm-hmm. It was also a gift.
I'm still back in the program.
Okay.
Because I was in New Guinea, and I'm trying to think a little bit about what the other kinds of characteristics of a people that has a strong sense of gift exchange as opposed to market economy. And Dave, there's all those islands down there have a kind of balance to their, it's both a positive and a negative. For instance, if you have a war, you only take what you've lost. I mean, that is, if one man has been killed in a tribal fighting, you only fight it so long as you get the payback. I mean, that's what it's a payback system. Yeah. And when that's been done, you stop. Whereas I'm trying to see if it's true to say that in a market economy, you're always trying to get more than what you've been.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. To accumulate like, and.
It's
right.
It's a kind of a horse trader's paradise in which you get more than what you've given.
Yeah.
And then to say something perhaps about Christianity, in which we get more than we ever imagined.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I really don't know if it makes any sense. It seems to me that the balance, where, for instance, the bad part of it is that, well, payback system is so precise that you can't give a gift.
Yeah.
That's too big because you have to make sure that you won't offend, and it's necessary for them to pay back what they have been given. So if you have the Eucharistic meal and you have this sense of paying for the elements, you pay for it, it's very difficult.
Yeah, he talks about, if these ideas intrigue you at all, I really recommend the book because he goes into so many of the different kind of tangents that I think make it interesting that I just didn't have time to get into, but you're suggesting some of them there. I mean, one thing that he makes very clear is that gift exchange doesn't happen back and forth between two people. If you and I keep giving gifts back and forth, there's a kind of stasis that's involved, and it's not the same sort of dynamic movement. I mean, that's why he suggests the Trobriands even have two circles to kind of to complicate things in a healthy way. He also spends a fair amount of time talking about some of the potentially unhealthy consequences of the attachments involved in gift exchange. For instance, when we all get to, past adolescence into adulthood, there comes a point when it is healthy for us to stop depending on our parents' gifts and to actually make a break. He has an example in there of a woman, I believe it was, who lived in the black community of Chicago, who came into some money, and the relatives immediately came to her, and everybody wanted a piece of it, right? And she found it necessary, to leave, and he wasn't being critical of that at all. There are times when there are attachments that we need to sever, and we need to sometimes stop the gift giving. In order to make those...
I'm wondering if there is something that is affected in terms of relationships when gifts become separated from our own creativity. I mean, for instance, if all of your gifts are things that you don't make, uh-huh. but you just buy because uh-huh. you're in a market economy, there isn't the same... Then the attachment is simply not... It's not a right. matter of creativity, it's right. a matter of how much did it cost.
Right. Yeah, and kind of a parallel example of that might be what happened to some of the potlatch ceremonies after there was a great deal of contact between the Northwest natives and white folks, because all of a sudden there were different consumer goods available which started being used at potlatches instead of the kind of traditional gifts of handmade blankets and so forth. What they would do is go and buy all these white man goods and there was great waste, and you know, it kind of was not treating the ritual with respect. Somehow the introduction of those consumer goods just ruined the whole thing. So yeah, it's he also has some kind of interesting paragraphs, perhaps it's even a whole chapter of where he talks about in the Old Testament the lending of money that becomes yeah. another piece of that whole thing, and how you were not allowed to lend money at interest within the people, yeah. but you had to go outside the people, and you know,
interest from the Gentiles.
Right, right, and you know, and you know, a lot of the economy around the time of the Reformation was dependent on that sort of lending money between Jews and Christians. They couldn't do it among themselves, so they became dependent on each other. So it's a fascinating subject that has many different applications.
David, I want to go back to the throwaway question that that I'm assuming was your father that asked. What if your parents had given you the green bowl?
What?
I mean, I want you to answer that seriously.
Yeah.
And because they have given a gift that,
yeah.
that has given enormous
yeah.
pleasure,
yeah.
in spite of the fact
yeah.
that it has given it in a way that was totally
yeah.
different
yeah.
than initially intended.
Yeah, that's it. I guess I hadn't, yeah.
I'd rather that you didn't just throw that one away
yeah.
and say,
yeah.
you did,
yeah.
you know.
Well, I think if they had given it to me,
yeah.
I don't think we would have treated it the
Precisely.
Way we did.
Precisely.
You're right.
Or if it was done by a famous glass blower. It reminds me of the story of the person who had a gift of a painting and had it in a hallway and then found out that it was by someone, you know, a valuable painting, and it then became, you know, the centerpiece in her living room.
There's,
you know,
also
even though it was an ugly
mm-hmm.
green bowl, but
right.
it,
right.
You know, there's the question of relationships.
Sure.
When relationships are strong enough that people can even find the humor in these things and the joy out of doing it, and maybe even made a mistake in giving a gift. Mm-hmm. How many of us haven't done that? You know, and so the type of relationships you've got within that circle can make all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. I know in our school of a... our drama teacher was given by her brother an ugly portrait of an austere woman, a big busted woman, you know, with glasses and everything like that. And it's amazing. He had an idea. That thing has showed up just about every other year in one of the dramas. And has just brought, you know, tremendous joy. And it seemed like an ugly gift at the beginning, but he had the wisdom to know both his sister and the potential value of something like this. And she was creative enough that for 15 years, she used that thing regularly.
Elmer Witt and I exchanged a pot that had come through the Narnia pottery class. And we had a big auction here, and And I was bidding against Elmer, and I let him win finally at the price of about $75. I paid for this awful rock pot, and it was really whooped looking in the first place. And so he got this thing, and the next Christmas I got it in the mail. So then I sent it back to him, and then he sent it back to me, and we exchanged this for about I would guess probably six. Holidays, and then it broke in the mail. But just think of the pleasure we had all this time, plus they got $75 for it here. So it was fun. But that is a dynamic, like you were saying, the appropriate.
I think a real intrinsic part of this that is often real hard to face when you are giving gifts and you're thinking this relationship is really being, you know, and even if it is things that you're making, things that are special like that, it's real hard to learn or to train yourself not to expect something in return. And like, I mean, it's just realistic. That's just kind of how we are sometimes. And I think that in the story of the elves, you know, they gave him the clothes and then the elves left. Mm-hmm. You can't imagine he was like, oh, yeah, he left. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's a hard kind of reality about it. But it's also an important part because then when you don't expect anything, it's all the better when you do get something. You might not expect it. But I mean, that's an important side to that.
Well, the shoemaker had received a gift from the elves, and it was partly a gift of affirmation that got him back on his feet. That's the sort of assurance that often comes in that relationship building function of gifts. I'm honestly not trying to sell this book, but I really Lewis Hyde. Hyde. Imagination, subtitle, Imagination and the Erotic Life of Property. If nothing else, it's a great book to put on the coffee table because people see the subtitle and wonder what it's about. But it's that eros is the sense of joining. And so, you know, imagination, the gifts of creativity and the erotic life of property. When property, when goods move between people, what sort of joining functions does it have in that motion? That's the kind of explanation of the subtitle.